Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Pull up a pew and have a brew. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another exciting episode of Super Fan Chats. We are going to be talking about episodes 79 through 81, and this is me, Jeremy Cobb, pronouns he, him, but it's not just me. I'm not talking about myself in the plural, what would that be, plural first person? There's two other people here to talk about it with me. Y'all can jump in whatever order you want to introduce yourselves.
Yeah, Superfan Han is back. One of the Superfan Hans.
One of the
not Lord Crumpet, the other one.
And Superfan Pip.
Yay! Woo!
Yeah! This was a very fun trio of episodes.
Yeah.
We finally broke away from the horrific bug larvae that were implanted sure in the last trio. Should we just jump straight in with episode 79?
Sure.
Yes, let's go for it. So I was going to recap episode 79, Wilder Queen's Grace.
Great.
So speaking of the bug larvae, this is where we finally begin to branch away from them because Gwendolyn's surgery was a success. And after she's woken up, the party discuss what they know of the Wilder Queen. When Grove Mother Vanalo returns with food, they all play a game of questions, leading to a small experiment of Enkidu drinking holy water to test how demonic he could be. After Gaius persuades the Grove Mother to transport them closer to Geremir Hastan's location, Juna made soup, Gwendolyn interacted with the Wilder Queen's effigy, and Enkidu joined Vanalo in preparing some holy water. Over dinner, Juna shared a story of light and dark, and Vanalo told them what she knew of henges, including a tale of the dancing maidens of Ashhenge. As the day dawned, Vanalo opened a path to the corrupted area of the Crownswood. Pushing through the mud, they skirted a small lake, at which point a glowing light across the water signaled the return of the original Abracalad, Orin. And as he sploshed into the mud, a ripple drifted across the dark surface of the lake, ending on quite the cliffhanger.
It really did, yeah.
It was a really... really chilled kind of episode for most of it. It was very much hanging out in nature, shooting the breeze with Vanalo.
Yeah, it was good vibes.
Kind of playing some games, having a think, telling some stories, and then finally going, best we gotta get going. And then Orin appears, the end.
Yeah. And it's a nice set of episodes where we've got almost, by the time we get to the third episode of like bringing us all up to date with this is what most of the party is doing, and then a little bit later this is what Orin's been up to, and then finally we kind of see everything kind of track back. It's nice how we sort of get references back to that.
Picking up on some threads that I think necessarily went like a little bit dormant previously,
yeah.
You know, just in terms of all the busyness of like the bugs and the surgery and this and that, and then actually we're getting back to where are we going, why are we doing it, what's going on, what's the bigger objective,
yeah.
Let's have a little probe, maybe some looking into some personal objectives as well,
yeah.
And kind of, or it almost felt like a recollecting or like a regathering,
yes,
of everybody's sort of thoughts,
yes,
and kind of going, whoa, okay, wait, where are we? What's happening? Which I appreciated as someone who sometimes struggles to remember exactly who is who with all the really cool fantasy names.
Yeah,
that
I'm getting
David
to that point now. Yep.
Brings where I'm like, Geremir Hastan, he's the demonologist?
He is, yeah.
He is, okay, mm-hmm. cool. I'm trying to keep that one straight because that is a particular arc that I find really interesting.
Yes.
But there are a lot of different names where I sometimes get a bit confused about who is who.
Yeah, mm. They are good names yeah. as well, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic.
I would love to see a full wiki, like, NPC list.
Yes,
Because David has created, yeah, he's created such an array. Like, Zaravir and Garamir, really, those yes. ones are the ones that really, like, that. Those are the two that I'm like, man. And then some of, but they're both good names is the thing. Like, mm-hmm. it's quality stuff. But I would love to see a full NPC list so it'd be easier to kind of keep track of the large cast that we've developed. Great.
Yes. Yeah. David, please, can we have this list?
Petition for someone, not me, to make a No Small Roles wiki, which also has like an interactive map.
I would
love
click
that. On the region and see who they met where.
Yes.
Yeah.
And which episodes those are. So you'd like
yeah.
click on the grove and you see Vanala. Mm-hmm. And that would be really cool. Or you'd, you know, click another place and you'd see all the other characters, like all the children of Havoc or something like that. Mm-hmm. That would be great. So if anyone's a dab hand and wants to make a fan wiki
yep.
that has an interactive map, someone do that.
That would be cool.
That would be so cool.
Yeah, it would be cool.
I feel like we'd get so much more fan art as well, because we'd need a picture of all of the characters.
Oh, yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
I did once do a doodle of Gwen, and that was really fun.
Oh.
Like, I do enjoy a little bit of fan arty stuff, but I haven't done drawing for ages. But maybe this year I'll have more time to draw bits of No Small Roles,
because
it's really fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're fun to draw.
I would also like to advocate a No Small Roles Baldur's Gate 3 like co-op where people create all the characters. Because you can make most of them to some extent.
Jeremy, before we got on mic, I was just telling Pippa how I got Baldur's Gate 3 as a Christmas present and I'm obsessed.
Isn't yeah. it really good?
It's so good. I'm yeah. so obsessed. As soon as we get stopped talking about No Small Roles, I'm going to go back to Baldur's Gate. That's where I'm going to be.
Yeah.
Full disclosure, that's where I'm at for the next several hours.
Yeah.
But this is a No Small Roles podcast, not a Baldur's Gate podcast.
I did make a Dwayne Fabulosa. I think I posted it in the Discord. I made
you
a
did.
Dwayne Fabulosa.
Yes.
Yeah. His
yes,
hair,
I saw that.
His hair is different than it should be, but the game has limited curly hair options. But
yeah.
I think Gwendolyn is his guardian. I made Gwendolyn as his guardian. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so good.
Yeah.
That's so good. Yeah, I definitely think, yes, I would be down for that, basically.
But I back to No Small Roles. I cheered. I was walking around a Walmart when I was listening to this episode, and I like had the instinct to cheer when Enkidu was like, "Hey, can you please tell me more about what exactly I am? Because I've been
yeah.
like." And it may just be the way that my brain works, but if I'm in a position where there's all these like top secret operations that we're a part of, and there's large scale, like there's multiple large scale political groups that we are interacting with,
mm-hmm.
and one of our members is possibly a synthetic version of themselves who is maybe being spied upon by some sort of like nigh omniscient artificial intelligence
yep.
that is in
that happens to have a golem army at their disposal
yes.
and may also have made them into a sleeper cell of
yes.
some variety.
That would probably be top priority. I would have
right?
like
I really feel like this is what I mean about collecting the threads
yeah.
that may have become loosened or dropped.
Yeah.
Like, and I think it is a real credit to Daryl that he's such a team player that, you know, everyone's individual backstories really do get a lot of equal airtime.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really, it's such an ensemble cast.
Mm-hmm.
But with a story like that, with a plot beat like that, it would be so easy for that to take center stage all the time. Because, as you said, Jeremy, like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Like, that's, he's such a potential liability. Like, we gotta, are there some spells we can cast to sever somebody's hold over him? Like, non-detection or something that we can, somebody who can cast stuff, teach it, like, these, that would be where my mind would have gone. So the fact that we finally circled back around to that, I was like, oh, thank you, thank you!
Yeah,
my God, yes, it was really gratifying to have that moment where it was like, oh, finally, they actually, like, are curious about it and, like, trying to get the answers that we all want to hear. not a huge amount of answers, but I did also think that drinking holy water was an interesting experiment.
That was a there was a choice.
Yeah. I would not, honestly, of all the options, I would not have expected infernal as like a likely option. You know what I mean? Mm. Considering they didn't, I don't recall them really witnessing or sensing anything that was particularly infernal while they were there. Not that any of them are like clerics or paladins.
Yeah.
But I got the vibe that he's probably more like he's synthetic in some way.
Yeah.
Although there was that thing about, well, so this is, I'm curious about, because this is a homebrew world that David's made.
Yeah.
I'm curious about whether David has a distinction like sort of more classic Faerun D&D does between devils and demons, mm-hmm. and whether demonic and infernal are different in this particular setting. Because that would make quite a difference, wouldn't it? Because I don't think demons have a similar, the same reaction to holy water that devils do. Mm. And Gerimer Hastan is a demonologist.
Yeah.
So would that might change things a little bit, but then who knows? It really is dependent on sort of the lore of David's world. And I don't think that's something we've particularly had much indication of. Although I've heard maybe in previous campaigns there was something to do with Lolth. So maybe.
Yeah, that was a big thing.
I don't know.
Was there? You said, Pip, you were saying there was a big thing about Lolth?
Yeah, in a previous campaign set in this world that David ran, which is part of the reason that this world is like so rich and detailed, as he's been working on it for a really long time and run other campaigns in it. I think there was a lot of plot involving Lolth, but then he could have completely changed it for no small roles.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, it's hard to know. So I guess that's a question for baby David.
And I think Vicky's the only, I might well be wrong about this, but I think Vicky's the only cast member who's been in both.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So just questions about, you know, would holy water have done anything if he had demonic stuff going on, which has been indicated that he does, particularly with to do with all the patrons and stuff. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, there is the question of Erida, has that been tampered with because of the replacement of the synthetic?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, is he a construct?
Maybe. Have we determined whether healing spells still work on him, though, right?
Yeah.
Has somebody?
They seem to. I think so.
Yeah, I'd have to look at the exact rules, but there are specific. Depending on the healing spell, it doesn't work if you're not a humanoid. Actually, let's do that right now. We're talking about the episode, and this is a topic that gets brought up in the episode. Let me see. Mm. It would be, I think, cure wounds or healing word. There might be like a reason that it wouldn't work. Let me see.
Okay.
Let me see. Cure wounds. Let me look at the actual language of the spell. Cure. And again, they may have homebrewed it, so this may not be 100% accurate. But cure wounds, a creature you touch, but this spell has no effect on undead or constructs. So we'd have to go back and look to see if anyone has used cure wounds on Enkidu since he died.
Yes, and whether it's been successful.
I accept that challenge.
Lawmaster Pip, digging back through the archives.
I'm joking,
oh boy. Healing Word also has no effect on undead or constructs.
Interesting.
Man, Healing Word is such an annoying spell. I just...
you really hate it?
So you think it's going to be really useful, and then you realize that if a party member is unconscious, they can't hear, so it doesn't work on them.
I don't know if I would interpret.
Well, it depends. I guess it depends on your DM.
And also, Healing Word does not specify they have to be able to hear you. Healing Word says
a
creature.
Not? I thought it did.
It says a creature of your choice that you can see within range.
Oh,
that's why it can work even if somebody's like deaf, for example.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I have definitely played games where the rule has been, well, if you can't hear it, it doesn't work.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it depends on the DM, but in the spell itself does not specify
that. Ableist. Now I'm wondering, is that ableist towards deaf characters?
Potentially, yeah. Because are you having to like learn sign language in order to heal them? You have to like wave and like do sign.
It's a somatic. That's the somatic component.
Yeah,
is signing the
getting
healing
their
word.
Attention.
Yeah, and does that count for things like Word of Radiance as well?
Ooh, yeah. Let me actually look with Word of Radiance. You utter a divine. Yeah, no. It's each creature of your choice that you can see.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, good job avoiding some ableism there, D&D. But in the case of Healing Word and those other healing spells, if they have ever worked on Enkidu, unless it's one of those situations where the group just didn't really like look it that in depth on it, or if they just changed the rules so that those spells can work on constructs, yeah. which is entirely possible, then it's possible that Enkidu would not be considered a construct. Again, mechanically speaking, he seems the most similar to a Reborn or a Warforged, in that he doesn't need to eat, he doesn't need to sleep. He just sort of sits there and, like, just sits there motionless, basically.
Yeah. It's such an interesting point of, like, we still don't really know what he was before, what happened to him, and what he is now.
Yep.
In all instances. Like, we don't know how he got all his friends in his head. Mm. We don't know what that made him into or what he was before that event. And we also don't know exactly what Erida did to make him into what he is now and what that is. So, like, he's just such an enigma.
Yeah. That's
he's so mysterious.
I'm amazed that at the restraint that the party has shown in never, like, grabbing each other and be like, okay, we're going through this whole thing right now. you're just gonna tell me, look, I know you've got your secrets, your things you're trying to work through. My guy, you died and came back as some kind of robot man. We're gonna have to come clean on this one.
And prior to that, there was an explosion. You blacked out for years and came to with several of your friends inside your mind.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The fuck? And they're still here somehow, even though you're a robot man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What is this? I really wanted to be like, Juna, detect thoughts. Here we go. The moment you've been waiting for. Sit them down.
Yes. I 100% agree.
Prize open those secrets, damn it.
Yeah. Oh, man. I can't wait. Like, I hope that at some point either Enkidu completely, like, comes clean, and as well as the rest of the party, and is just like, all right, here's the deal. We're casting a zone of truth. We're all going to intentionally fail it. We're all just going to come clean and say exactly what's happening here. Or
that would be such a fun drinking game.
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
That would be such a fun in-character drinking game where it's like, okay, we all get drunk, intentionally fail zone of truth, and then play truth or dare.
Yes. Oh, that's brutal. That actually does sound like a lot of fun.
We should suggest this. If we don't get all the answers by the end of the campaign, they just have an episode where we have Ask Me Anything with Zone of Truth.
Yes.
Bonus content.
Yes.
Like a one-shot where they're all just hanging out. Like all the characters are hanging out. Zone of Truth, drinking. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. I would love that. That would be so good.
And Dwayne needs to be involved as well.
Oh, heck yeah.
Dwayne is also there inexplicably.
Because he kind of can't, also he there. Can't really fail all these things, right? So
yeah, that's true. Well, he can fail the wisdom save. That's the one thing. Thankfully, it's not a perception persuasion or deception. Mm-hmm. I think it's a wisdom saving throw. And if you can choose to fail it, and the person knows whether you failed it or succeeded. Okay. The only kind of character that could fool that still would be, I believe, a mastermind rogue. When they get to like level 11 or something, it becomes impossible to force them to tell the truth. Mm. I'm pretty sure it's something like they still have to like roll persuasion or deception, but like mind reading doesn't work on them. You will hear whatever they want you to hear. So if you see the truth, it's because they wanted you to. And the same thing applies with Zone of Truth. They can fool Zone of Truth into thinking that they did fail, and then, but that's not what Dwayne is. He's an eloquence bard. So
God, I love a rogue. They're so fun. Preferred character class to play is this my one is a rogue always.
I'm a little surprised that nobody like multi-classed into rogue.
Mm.
Like Gaius in particular.
I feel like he would be, with his sort of criminal background, would be such a good pick for a rogue bard. Especially the masked bard. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Chris, think about it.
Yeah, Chris, think about it. The last
Chris,
few episodes.
Think about it. Chris, have you thought about multi-classing? Think about it.
thief rogue. It's pretty decent. It's pretty good.
Oh my god. It's great.
Yeah.
It's great. So it's cunning actions. So helpful.
Very true. Yeah, cunning action is very, very useful. Was there anything else that we wanted to talk about in this particular episode?
I mean, there were amazing stories.
Yeah.
Oh, Juna, was that the one Juna had the whole story that was really cool?
We had
the light
did.
And dark one.
Yeah. That was sick. Good job, Vicky.
Yep.
Yeah. She writes such great stories.
Yeah.
That are so in character and like so in keeping with the themes and the vibe of the lore of the world.
Yeah.
Just like hats off.
Yep. And it was so impromptu as well. I mean, like, I think she said it wasn't even really finished, but it sounded amazing.
Yeah. Like, if that's unfinished, my word. I know. What does it sound like when it's done?
Yep.
Yeah, right?
And the drow translation as well. That was really cool.
Yeah. Mm. And I really liked the idea, because this was also the episode where they told the story about the Orcosians who were like
the nine
trying
maidens.
Trying to trap fire, and that Carhilda was one of them, but had like not shown up to the ceremony for whatever reason, or just wasn't involved, was not trapped.
Yeah.
So cool.
Which is fascinating. I'm trying to work out how that ties into the Carhilda story that we got from the Spoon Winners, because they had a different sort of story about Carhilda and how they were danger and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Did they go into specifics about what Carhilda? Because I knew that it was like anyone with the name Carhilda represents potential threat, but I don't remember the specifics of the story.
I don't think they gave much more than that. No. I do think it was quite vague that the name Carhilda was sort of an ill omen.
Yeah.
But then sort of through digging around about it and doing some sort of last minute research in the moment, they kind of, I think Gwen, did she do a sort of check with one of the gods or something where she found, or someone did, just to get the sense of... Actually, Carhilda is very, it's kind of almost like what you make it. Like, there will be a great battle.
Yeah.
And it will be, Carhilda will be part of it. Like, danger is coming if Carhilda appears. But actually, Carhilda could be.
It was almost the protector
hero.
As well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like because, you can't separate the two.
Exactly. So, because it's linked to the danger, they've been sort of, it's become this very ill omen. But actually, there's a lot more choice and ability to change fate around that.
Yeah.
And I think it's so cute that this episode is the one where Gwen, after her surgery is successful, she has a look and like has a scar. And
oh,
she's I'm fate marked now, kind of. And everyone's like,
oh, yeah, you are.
Gwen.
That was very cute.
That was super cute. Also, badass scar addition.
Yep.
Yeah.
Can't just have Gaius.
Exactly. Everybody's got a scar by the end of this.
I think they all do now, actually. Genuinely, they all do, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Doesn't Enkidu have his weird markings?
Enkidu had some marking on his hand.
Mm-hmm. And Oren's got interesting
his leg brace thing going
stuff
on.
Gwen's got a scar.
Juno's got tattoos.
A bunch of tattoos. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think so.
Gaius is missing half his face.
Yeah.
Full Phantom of the Opera. I was also, let me see, in this particular episode, so one last thing about Carhilda before I jump to the next thing.
Yeah.
Carhilda, it could be that Carhilda betrayed them and joined with the Fire Spirit.
Ooh. I like
and
that.
And it could be that, like, because we don't really know whether what they were doing was appropriate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We just know that they were trying to do it. We don't know that the Fire Spirit was necessarily good or evil, or if the Fire Spirit was at all, like, aligned in that way. Mm-hmm. The Fire Spirit could have been a pretty neutral entity, and Carhilda could have recognized that trying to imprison it and take its power was wrong, and joined with it to then imprison the maidens in return. It could have been something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe Carhilda was the Fire Spirit.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun.
I love that. I think David does this really well, is that like really morally gray, like there are so many stories about different things where actually nothing is black and white. It's all about perspective.
Yeah, it's so open to interpretation.
Trying to figure out who's good, who's bad. You know, they meet some people and there's an instant dislike, like Heron Ilwyn, you're like, oh, there's the Children of Havoc. This is all dodgy. But at the same time, are they against other baddies that are also bad? So are they actually good but... they're really dodgy. So it's this real like push-pull of like, there's no clear sides of anything. Just many different perspectives and truths. And it's just such good storytelling.
All those juicy threads.
Yeah.
Speaking of good storytelling though, should we move on to episode 80?
Oh, sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Excellent. I am going to recap episode 80, which was called Whistle Stop Artificer, a.k.a. Oren and Petra's Week of Fun.
I love it.
That's such a misleading title.
I know, right? So after sending the rest of the party towards Kissing Beck, Oren and Petra remained at the tipple. Petra apologised to Oren and explained that she needs his help, and the pair agreed to work together. Whilst possessed by Petra, Orin's recollection of events was hazy at best, and he found himself in the company of Wayland de Lavaux and Lord Berrien. Berrien was aware that Orin had a connection to Prevost, but the both of them were evasive about their plans and motives going forwards. Afterwards, in an upstairs tavern room in Mervai, Orin warned Petra that Lord Berrien might not be entirely trustworthy, and with a very full stomach from Petra's overindulging, they started to work on Orin's consortium application. Later, Petra and Orin snuck into the Halcron Palace and were almost discovered after an ill-timed scrying spell from Juna. They met Sigrid, and Orin asked her for more information about the Henges. Upon leaving the palace, there was an alarming incident, where Chargrel, as fake Petra, discovered them, and the pair only just escaped to Lyodon's downfall in the Woden Isles. Once Orin had recovered from his wounds, they teleported to the University of Aeland and bumped into Dwayne! With Dwayne's help, they managed to locate the party, and as promised, Petra returned Orin to the party through a portal, continuing her mission in Dwayne's company instead.
Yeah.
And it was lovely to have you back, Jeremy. That was such a welcome surprise.
Oh, thank you.
Genuinely didn't know that was going to happen, and it was very exciting.
Yeah. It was so cool.
Yeah.
It was wonderful to get to be back. It was really, really fun. I listening to it, I said this before we started recording, but I don't remember when we recorded it, but I'm afflicted at this point to always forget basically everything I've recorded. And so while I knew that I was in the episode, I didn't have any memory of what actually happened or what I had done. So I was like listening to
you were possessed by Dwayne and had no recollection. Yeah. The events were hazy.
It's not even me performing, darling. It's Dwayne performing through me. I had zero memory of what we'd actually done. So listening back to it, I was like, oh, dang, this is cool. It was a blast. That was a real... I do remember it being a very fun time.
And I guess you had no context going into it either.
No, I just knew that because Ben was on tour in America... Mm-hmm. He hadn't been able to record with the rest of the gang, so I jumped in as like an extra special guest during his side episode, but I knew nothing about it except that he was in another place, and I can't remember if they had released even the episode where he'd been possessed by that point. I can't even remember if they'd released it by then.
They probably hadn't, because that was relatively recent, I think.
Well, it's been a couple months, though, right?
But they've had a lot of other like side adventure releases in between and stuff, so I think that it was quite a slow trickle of the main campaign episodes.
Yeah, I think I might be wrong, but I think all the Deacon horror stuff came out.
That's true, yeah.
In between.
Yeah, I think you're correct.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
And a familiar problem. That was another one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes.
Yeah. So I don't think I'd heard the episode yet. I think I knew that Orin got possessed or something. Yeah. But yeah. I had very little memory of it other than that. But yeah, it was a blast. It was really, really fun to get to do that.
Was it a surprise for Ben as well? I mean, did they know you were sort of sitting in the Zoom waiting to come on and then David let you in straight away, or?
I can't remember. I think it may have been a surprise. I have a look.
It sounded
Facebook.
Kind of like a surprise. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I think Baby David would have messaged me on Facebook. I'm gonna see if I can find the messages and everyone else keep talking. I'm just gonna look.
That's right. That's good.
I think what I love about it as well is like Dwayne and Orin
are like polar opposites. Yeah.
Didn't really interact much. Yeah, they didn't really chat much. There wasn't a huge amount of like Dwayne, Orin, one-on-one bonding time when they actually did meet.
Yeah, I mean, there was nothing really, yeah.
So there's this random Orin guy, and I think you played that so well, Jeremy, and I know you mentioned it in the last Superfan chat, where like, yeah, where's this person from? Oh yeah, Gwen, was with Gwen, right, okay. But also like, sorry, who is this dude? What's, why? Who is this small human? Is he a human or half? He's a halfling. Is he a halfling or a human?
Dwayne's a halfling.
Dwayne's a halfling. Orin. But
Orin's a human.
Yeah. Orin is a human. Just
Orin's
a very,
just a very
one.
Short human.
Yeah. Okay.
Who's associated a lot with gnomes in the past.
Yeah. Yeah.
My theory is that he's maybe part gnome.
Ooh. Yeah. Okay.
Half gnome.
Okay.
Maybe like a third.
Think with the artificing as well.
Yeah. I don't know. Or maybe there was some magical like influence from the gnomes when he was with them.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And I guess if you think the last time that those two interacted, there was, you know, big musical party on the boat and then the boat blew up.
Yeah.
Neither of which, I mean, apart from Orin making the battery creature much bigger with you know, more fire spells and things like that.
RIP horse friends.
Yeah, I know.
Bessie. Yeah, Bessie.
We miss you. We miss you every day.
But yet there wasn't a lot of interaction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they had basically not spoken. And I think that was why, like, I don't think I re-listened to the episode, but I'm pretty sure they barely interacted at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was just very much that guy who was there. And
who was there kind of a bit awkward.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I said this in the Discord, but basically Dwayne remembers Gwendolyn. He remembers Juna because Juna's the one who kept violating his mind.
Yes.
And he remembers
and yelling
Guy.
At him.
Yeah, and also yelled at him a lot. Yeah. And then Guy is also a bard and is the one who forced him to tell the truth. So those are the main three that he remembers. But he remembers that Orin and Enkidu exist. He just doesn't remember their names or necessarily where he knows them from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is fair. Yeah.
And it's so funny. I don't know if you guys have this, but sometimes like I remember people's faces, but I find it really hard to figure out who they are because I only know them from a context. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I know I know you. I know I should smile at you and talk to you, but I have no idea what your name is, where I know you from, what's going on here. And then as soon as the context comes in, I'm like, oh, yes, it's all coming back to me. Mm-hmm. But and sometimes that's been awkward where I've seen people who I think, oh, maybe they're my friend, but actually they've just been someone I've seen on TV a lot or something, kind of smiled at them and they look at me awkwardly. And then I'm like, oh, no, I'm sorry.
Just being friendly is fine.
Yeah, I'm just someone who thinks you're my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what, because we never really got a full report on what exactly had, what exactly was said, right?
Mm.
We never, or sorry, what exactly was done while Orin's body was being controlled? Like, we got an idea, but we don't know exactly who they're organizing with and against.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Yeah, what do we think about that? The murkiness of all of that.
David.
Yes, David. I think it was brilliant, and I would have also hated to have been put on the spot of, here are two very important characters, here's a Delavaux, and here's Lord Beryon. Off you go, Ben.
Yeah.
That was big. Like, I love the fact that you just drop him straight into a face-to-face meeting with Beryon with no preparation whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he handled it really well. And there's always going to be that retrospective thing of like, if only I'd asked this, but then would Orin have done that anyway? Because he's always made it quite clear that he doesn't want to get involved with the political side of things and wants to separate himself from that as much as he can. So I think, yeah, maybe that was for the best.
Yeah, and Orin is not the talker of the group, let's be real.
Oh, no.
hard to get words out of that kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And any words at all.
Yeah.
He's a shy boy.
And apart from,
Remember his, like, his potentially secret love interest that we haven't, I feel like we haven't mentioned that dude in the way, but it was like, was it a colonel or like a chief or some military dude?
Yeah, I think so. Yep. Yeah. Guys tried to poke him for some answers.
Yep.
Yeah. He didn't get very far.
He's so secretive. Juna, detect thoughts.
Now that Dwayne has legend lore, if he ever meets up with the group, they just need to sit down and be like, okay, cracking the knuckles, let's just do this thing.
Between Dwayne and Juno, it would be like, let's violate everyone's fucking privacy.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Who is this guy?
Let's tear this wide open, everyone.
Yeah. It's going to be like a meta, no small questions.
Yeah. It's just Dwayne over the course of weeks casting legend lore over and over and over again.
I love it when there are very few players, but multiple characters. So David has to interact with himself.
Yes.
That was such a delight to hear. He's so good at it.
Yeah.
And like having DM campaigns where that's happened, where there's been like multiple NPCs and the party have decided to let them talk to each other. Like personally, I have felt awkward as hell having to do that. Basically like role play an entire conversation between two people that are both just me.
Yep.
But David does it so well.
He really does. I think this whole episode was really, really well put together from like a stylistic and structural standpoint. The idea of like us, because obviously there was no way for us to be able to see every single moment of what Orin was doing. And we had a lot of time to cover. So I think having him just be, have whole chunks of time that he basically loses was a very effective way of doing it, while also obfuscating all of the details and keeping an air of mystery so that we don't have to then explain. David doesn't have to then sit down and give exposition for the entire plot. Because we don't know exactly what all was said, but I get the impression that our gang does not know nearly as much as like Petra does. That Petra is kind of in on, like, she's up on pretty much everything that's been going on. That's my impression anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's trying to find out, having been trapped in a jar for the last however many years, but she has this like base knowledge of a lot of other stuff from
the 30 years ago
before, and B, from like the being able to kind of listen in into whatever was going on around during that time and absorb whatever information that she could. So she's definitely got an edge when it comes to certain bits of information, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Given
what's been alluded to with the Delavaux and that they're not potentially a very good, nice family, either of you have minor alarm bells when Petra said that they were the one that supported the application to the consortium? Did you catch that?
Yeah. I get the impression that there's a lot of, like, that we're getting more and more a theme in this campaign of having to ally yourself with people that you may not fully agree, especially whenever you get into politics, you're going to have to make alliances with people who are just like, if anyone here listens to Three Black Halflings, and you've probably heard me waffle on about this game, but my favorite video game is is Disco Elysium.
I mean, that would be amazing.
That would be wild. The Three Black Halflings video game coming straight.
I love Disco Elysium. It's so good. It's a work of genius.
Well, and that's a character. Specifically, I'm thinking of Evrart. And the fact that there's a character in the game who is a very political figure. There's a lot of politics a lot of the plot deals with the political situation of the world that you're in. And there's one character in particular who has all sorts of information about you and about stuff that you need. But in order to get that stuff, you have to help him advance his aims. And he's clearly a corrupt and bad guy.
Not a good guy, yeah.
But there are certain things that you just never will get if you don't help him. And as much as he's not a good guy, there's a case to be made that what he wants is ultimately better for that part of the city than what all the other factions want. So even though he himself is arguably, well, maybe not the worst, because there are some pretty bad people on the other sides as well. But you can't ally yourself with a purely good person. Similar to like Fallout New Vegas, that's another game where like there's all these different factions and all of them are bad or flawed in their own ways. And all of them have positive things they could offer the region. It's the same thing here, I think. There are a bunch of different factions. I don't think any of them are going to be completely good. Like, even if the people running them are okay, they're definitely in league with some people who are unsavory. That's my prediction. And I think that's what's happening here, is that Petra is not necessarily a bad person herself.
No.
Although the violation of Orin's bodily autonomy did have my hackles raised a lot more.
That's not cool at all.
Yeah. Orin took that in stride. I was sitting there like, I don't know about this one. I don't feel good about this.
That was real uncomfortable. And
I sorted out the toilet thing for you.
That was like,
and I've stuffed you full of food. It's like, okay.
Yeah. Oh boy. Some really like bad, edgy, like, this isn't cool. And like, Orin took it in stride, but it does make me think a bit about like, what's Orin's life been like and what's his concept of the boundaries he's allowed to have about himself and his person.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to survive, has he had to sacrifice certain boundaries so he doesn't know that he's actually allowed to say, that's not cool, don't do that.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know, it just makes me feel for Orin, makes me want to protect him, makes me want to be like, no, you're allowed to say no and stop people. Like, please. Yes. My heart.
Boundaries.
Yeah.
My heart.
The way it was presented did not seem to be intentionally saying, like, see, Petra's low-key bad. It seemed more like that's just kind of... She even apologized, and she seemed kind of, like, remorseful and that it was something that she couldn't really help. Like, it was sort of... She felt like she... Because it had been so long, so it's a little understandable. But it could be that either she's just not a great person herself, or that, in general, in order to get to those kinds of prominent positions, you have to be in league with some unsavory people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably true, right? Because, like, even the parties allied themselves. Well, I'm going to go back to Heron Ilwen, where it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, this guy seems legit. What? No, he doesn't. Or is he? But also, no. Is he a good person doing bad things to achieve good aims? Is he a bad person doing bad things to achieve less bad aims? Is, like, what's... The morality is so murky on all of it. And to be honest, when you ask, did alarm bells ring? I'm like, yes, all the time, with everything. There are alarm bells everywhere. None of this is safe. None of this is good. This is all very scary and unnerving. And it is that real thing of, like, who can you trust? How much? What should you reveal? What shouldn't you reveal? Is this going to blow up in your face? Is actually this a good alliance, but you should be wary? Can you trust this alliance? Like, I'm thinking about Kirda as well, where it's like, I want to trust that guy. I want to figure out, because I want to know so much more about, like, the balance and Juna's story and what that means and what Kirda knows and what Kirda's been told is another, you know, another part of that story. But then at the same time, there's some stuff where I'm a bit like,
It's kind of shady.
There's some weird, there's weird stuff that makes me go, is he a friend or, but then he feels like a friend, but then he's not, you know, it's just so many people where you're like, I think I could trust you. 70%.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just have to put numbers on it all now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is, but I think the fact that it's gotten to that point is, especially in a story like this, with a game like D&D, which I think D&D, in that it's a power fantasy, lends itself more to, like, cut and dry, this is the way things are, they're good or they're bad. Even when it comes to successes and failures, a lot of DMs will add more of, like, a graded success system, but ultimately, it's either supposed to be you succeed or you fail. And I think the DM, I think the Dungeon Master's Guide may include something like, well, you can, like, you know, mess with it a bit, but it's not like, for example, a Powered by the Apocalypse game where you can have partial successes or partial, you know, like, it's, oh, you sort of succeeded. Yeah. So you got some of what you wanted, but you also lost something. And I think the fact that they're telling a story where you can potentially succeed, but you're likely to lose something of yourself. Like, oh, yeah, sure. You made it through the Winthrop family trials, but you lost Enkidu. And also you found out, like, maybe these guys are completely evil and have an army of robots that they can use to wipe out, like, as much of the kingdom as they want. Stuff like that, where it's like, it's always sort of a mixed success. Which I enjoy those kinds of stories, especially if we're trying to do a slightly more grown-up fantasy, a political intrigue story.
Well, it feels more interesting because it feels like it gives way more space for character growth and for people to make interesting character choices when, you know, like, I agree, I think D&D is, it's very, in its purest form, is like, it's classic swords and sorcery, good versus evil, you know, based a lot on, like, Lord of the Rings, where you've got the big bad and the forces of good trying to stop the big bad. And it's so much more interesting when you put people who want to be good in situations where there is no option that does not hurt someone or something. How do you maintain integrity when you are pushed to make choices that have no purely good outcome? And that is just such an interesting place to put people.
Yeah. It's like the trolley problem, isn't it, I guess, in a way.
Yeah. You lose somebody no matter what. Baldur's Gate 3, actually, spoilers, has elements of that.
I was just about to say, that does it really well. Yeah. Like, there are so many instances where you can make a choice and you think you're doing the right thing, but guess what? Whole bunch of people going to die. Even if you make the right choice, you're still going to have a horrible part of this outcome that is going to feel real icky in some ways, and I find that much more interesting as well. But, you know, some people want a much more sort of pure, straightforward kind of black and white experience. Probably not the people who listen to No Small Roles if they're into it.
Yeah.
I think that is interesting, though, because in those kinds of stories, you usually have I feel like the tone of this show is a lot lighter than what you would normally expect from a story like that. Like, yeah. The tone of Disco Elysium or Fallout New Vegas or Baldur's Gate 3 or a lot of those other stories is much darker and generally heavier than No Small Roles tends to be. So I think it's interesting.
Yeah, No Small Roles really has a lovely kind of lightness of touch that keeps it from falling into these really like heavy spaces, which I appreciate as well, because
absolutely.
Like all these games are incredible, but also they're pretty like grimdark.
They can be
with moments of lightness.
Yeah, and I don't think I would describe this as particularly grim. This is not a grim show.
No, even though there are some incidents which actually are really grim, like they were tortured.
Yeah.
Like, they were tortured and then they had to torture animals to like get through the horrible Wingthrup maze and like steal their souls. And then there are all these golems, like I don't know. There's some moments where you're like, oh, this, if it were told with a different tone, this would be horror, but it's not because of the way they present it, which is great.
Yeah. And I think those moments hit harder because of that.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think David in particular has got that brilliant ability to sort of take something that seems quite lighthearted and then all of a sudden turn it on a dime, and before you know it, you kind of think, oh, actually, wow, it's taken a very different direction to where you thought you were going, perhaps.
Yes.
And then just flip it back again.
Oh, yeah. I think it's also a credit to the way that they all work together as a DM and players, because I'll always say, I think I've said it on this show before, that even though the DM may be the most important individual, the most important element to any game is usually going to be the players. Because there are more players than there are the DM. The players' choices are typically what's going to actually guide the story, especially in a campaign that's this long. You have long stretches, like almost every scene is going to have the characters involved. And they are going to affect the tone every bit as much, if not more, than the DM can. So David can throw in all these dark, edgy things, but if the cast comes in with a certain lightness of energy, which they do, I think the cast brings a lightness to it, where they're, even though they are invested in the situation and are taking it seriously, they're not taking it so seriously that things start to get really heavy. It's really a credit to the whole group, but especially I think the cast for lifting bringing a warmth and a lightness to a lot of these interactions. And then David responding to that in kind.
Yeah. And I have to say, just to bring it slightly more back to the episode we were talking about, speaking of lightness and fun, how's Dwayne enjoying Ayland?
Yeah,
he's having a good old time. I guess he's a little bit bored, but he's having a good old time. I'm not even, honestly, David and I just looked it up. I don't think David even, Ben did know, first of all, that I was going to be there.
Okay.
Ben did know I was going to be there, but I don't think they really gave me any details about what he's been doing there, other than that he's just been chilling. He's been chilling, hanging out there, doing whatever. Presumably, we'll find out at some point. I assume that Dwayne will appear in the series at some point before it's all over. Even if it's just for
please.
A cameo. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Please.
Yeah.
But that was a lot of fun. Thanks, team, for bringing me back. Should we go to the final episode?
Yeah, let's do
it. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. This is episode 81, Five Heads Are Better. With Orin reappearing on the edge of a lake, the party were about to celebrate when they were attacked by the many heads of a hydra, which, by the way, throwback to episode 79 when they were like, wait, did Orin disturb the water? Oh, definitely. Yeah, 100%. That was hilarious. Everyone leapt into action, with Juna and Orin flying into the air, Gaius sending shatter spells at each head, and Gwendolyn was swallowed a few times. Kidu epically sliced his way through the heads just as the party decided it was better to run, and with a tight tactic of Juna dropping Gaius onto Enkidu to teleport him to safety, and a step of the wind from Gwendolyn, all of them escaped the snapping heads. Continuing on their way, Orin recounted all that he had been through in their time apart, and as they settled down for a brief rest, the party explained their journey. So, right off the bat, this is the first combat we've had since the bugs, I think.
Yeah.
And I think this was a fun, we got to see more of how not only the characters have gotten more powerful, but how you can see that like Enkidu's, Daryl's Enkidu build of like mm-hmm. fighter and warlock had kind of come online by this point. And so he can do like a huge burst damage for a single round. And we're seeing how each of them have gotten more powerful and figured out like some of their new abilities. It was cool. I thought that was a fun little combat.
Yeah, I think they were leveled up to level 10.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have to say, slicing off a Hydra head. Dude.
Yeah.
Dude. What is number one rule with Hydras?
Well,
you see something with multiple heads.
That's a fun thing to play, though, isn't it? As a player, you know not to do that. But if you've never seen one before as your character.
Yeah.
Here is an interesting fact about the Hydra, assuming that David was using the Hydra from, is it the Monster Manual? Let me see, what is this from?
Yeah,
from
the basic rules. The Monster Manual.
From the basic rules. If you deal 25 or more damage in a single turn, one of the heads dies automatically to the Hydra. So by doing a bunch of damage to it at all, he was destined to take off one of its heads. And at the end of its turn, it grows two heads for each of its heads that died since its last turn, unless it has taken fire damage since its last turn.
Yeah. That's what definitely happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And is most of the group capable of dealing fire damage, or is it basically just like Auron and Juna?
I'm pretty sure it's just Auron and Juna, because I don't think Gaius has any fire spells. He's got Shatter, which is different. Obviously, that's thunder mm-hmm. damage, I think.
Yeah.
Or is it force damage?
Shatter is thunder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I don't think... does Enkidu? He's got like warlock spells. And I don't think...
He might have Hellish Rebuke.
Possibly. Well, that's a tiefling thing, isn't it?
Warlocks Hellish can get Rebuke? It too.
Oh, okay, cool.
But he was out of spell slots after his first turn, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
The warlock dilemma.
Yeah.
How many spell slots you got? Two.
Yeah, he would have just been shooting Eldritch Blasts for the rest of the fight.
Yeah, which is not typically, that's not fire damage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
can be a lot of damage, though.
Oh, yeah. Eldritch Blast is ridiculously powerful, which, if you've only got two spell slots, very handy. It was fun to have some combat.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fun.
We had the first not the first fireball of the campaign, but the first one dealt by a player as well.
Yay!
Fireball! What a great spell.
Which was good fun.
It is a real fun one.
Everyone's favourite.
Love it. Yep.
Yeah.
I like as well, I'm really enjoying as it goes on, and as you said about Daryl's character of Enkidu and how he's sort of really leaning into the build of the character, I love the amount of detail that he puts into his descriptions of what Enkidu's about to do. I know obviously he has like a martial arts background as well, but I find like everybody is brilliant, but out of all of them, when it like Enkidu's really, really comes through for me every time there's combat, I find him absolutely fascinating to listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's another area where the players can really add something that the DM can sometimes, but I feel like it's different when the players get into the descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
It adds a different flavor because they're going to describe things a little bit differently than the DM would.
Yeah.
And it just adds more, it adds more spice to the soup. And it's great. More seasoning.
Yeah. Into the soup. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Absolutely. A beautiful soup of people who are just so good with really, you know, it's not just, okay, I roll the dice and I deal damage. It has so much more character and flair to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can tell they're all actors, for sure, but particularly, I think, when they're describing what they're actually doing, like, it feels so much more like they are aware of the audience and how sometimes combat, you know, I love, you know, live play, real mm-hmm. actual play podcasts, and I love stuff like Critical Role, but sometimes I do kind of skip through the combat because
it doesn't,
you know, there's not so much going on in terms of the excitement. So when you have a bunch of players who manage to make it something you want to listen to, that's when you know they're like doing a great job.
Mm-hmm. And that's also a mixture of, I think, the DM and the players, because the player descriptions add a lot, like they add a huge amount.
Yeah.
But also you need a combat that's, number one, has some build up. That's like, that's half of the battle. If all of the emotions building up to it are exciting, and it's like, you have a situation, for example, where a bunch of people have been transported to this big, scary, like, marshy, swampy area. They're trying to contact a demonologist. They don't know what's up. And there's a huge lake that is obviously dangerous. They've been burned by stuff like this before. And they are deliberately trying to sneak their way around the lake after having just had a traumatic experience with a bunch of insect larvae and stuff. Yeah. There's all this, like, buildup. And then suddenly, their friend is back. Oh, boy! Like, there's excitement. But then, oh, no! Touch the water! Uh-oh! Like, that's, like, a fun little setup to get you. That gives you an initial boost of adrenaline into a combat where you're like, yeah! And then a Hydra pops out. Whoa! Big scary monster with a bunch of heads? Wow, what's this gonna be like? Like, that gives you a lot, but then you what you need to do is not have, like, 2 hours of just like, all right, so I'm gonna attack the Hydra. Okay, cool. Does a 19 hit? 19 hits, yes. Okay, cool.
It starts to sound like going through the motions, doesn't it?
11 damage.
It's it's that drives me nuts. I hate that so much. I'm like, if I wanted to hear you just read out numbers, I would not be listening to Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah. I would be listening to the shipping report.
Yeah, sure.
Like, like, come on, people. Yeah. It's not what this is about. It's about, like, the rules and the numbers are there, at least in my opinion, to simulate the action that is actually happening. Mm-hmm. And that's what the focus should be.
Yeah.
Is the rules are trying to recreate something, mm-hmm. not let's focus on these numbers now.
Yeah.
So, And that build up is also, it's like all that scene setting and getting you so ready to like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Like edge of your seat kind of stuff. Yeah. It's so great. And that kind of bait and switch of like, ah, something's happening. Oh my God, it's Arin. Oh no, it's a monster. That sort of whiplash between, oh God. Like, it's just, it really brings energy to something that can feel very flat.
An example, if you just say, okay, the Hydra, because on the actual stat block, the Hydra just bites. That's its only attack. It just bites. Okay. But if you say the Hydra bites, it's like, oh, the Hydra bites at you. Oh, it does a 21 hit? Yes, it does. Okay, that deals 11 points of slashing or piercing damage. And they're like, oh, man, that's different than like the Hydra's head darts out at you, slobber trailing in the wind. It clamps down on your body. Gwendolyn is now pinned inside of its jaws. And now people are like, oh, no, what's going to happen to Gwen? That's exactly. More important than like she just took 11 points of piercing damage. So that's
exactly.
Yeah, they do a great job, I think, of dramatizing the combats beyond just like going through the motions, which can get pretty dull. And I think that that's one of the advantages, actually, of Theater of the Mind, because you need to describe it in more detail to visualize it. Whereas in the case of Critical Role, they're using minis. So there's
you've got
less
the battle map, you've got the minis.
Exactly. There's less of an incentive to describe how everything's going to go.
In detail,
because you could just kind of see it.
And it seems to be only, you know, when in that particular show, when they have a particular move or like score a certain type of hit, then they describe it a bit more realistically. But there is a kind of like, it does become a lot about like the set and the minis, which is cool in its own way, but also as someone sort of watching, it's why I prefer to watch the YouTube of it rather than listen to the audio, because whenever combat comes up, I'm kind of like, well, I can't see the battle map, so it just sounds like people going over here, no, over here, behind this one. Okay. Oh wow, that's so cool. Isn't it? Okay, but what is it? What's happening? I can't see anything. And I do, I think there is something really to be said about that theater of the mind. And when I DM, I tend to have like very, very low tech battle maps, as in like scrawled on a piece of paper, just so that like distance and which enemy is attacking whom is able to be more easily kept track of. But I so much prefer the everyone having to pitch in to describe and set the scene, to bring it to life and to actually see what's going on. And it just feels way more. Fun and vibrant.
I think
and
it makes for
part of the world.
Yeah, I think it makes for more interesting storytelling as well, just overall, because everybody has a slightly different picture of that in their head, and that's where you get almost those negotiations of, well, how far can I move, and then oh, I can't do that, maybe I'll do this instead. And whereas if it's all visually laid out for you, you don't really get that kind of conversational, can I do this, can I not do this? Yeah, it's much more kind of directional and sort of less inventive, I guess.
Yeah.
Also, can I just say, love the fact they all decided to run away. I don't think we have enough of that in D&D.
Mm. Yep.
Like with D&D, it really feels like, no, we have to finish this fight. We're in a fight. We're going to finish it until we're the last one standing. Whereas actually, I tend to forget that run away is a perfectly good option.
Yeah.
Sometimes very much should be utilized.
Yeah.
So that felt very real as well. The idea that they would encounter this enormous monster and rather than like pushing themselves to be these like heroic adventurers battling it out to the end, they were like, fuck guys, this is too hard. Let's just go. Let's bounce.
We can't.
Yeah. We haven't got time for this. We've just recovered from horrible bug surgery. We have to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And look, we don't know that the Hydra's bad. It's just here. We don't know. Honestly, we don't know why the Hydra's here.
Yeah.
What does it eat?
Yeah. Well, Orin's. Gwendolyn's.
Clearly, yeah. It eats people trying to see the demonologist. Yeah. That's how it's able to thrive. But I did want to also highlight one other thing that jumped out at me in this episode was the fact that in a normal game, most of the time when there's been like some exposition given to a PC, they can just say, oh, I relay all of that to the rest of the characters.
Mm.
But after the fight, the bulk of this episode is exposition between characters, telling each other stuff that the audience already knows, which is very interesting because that's in like, if you're doing like a TV show, you wouldn't have that scene. You would just cut that scene and be like, they interact. And the only part of that that you would have shown really would have been like the new information, which would be the note that Gwendolyn reads, because that's the only thing that we haven't heard. But in the context of this game, the people genuinely don't know the information. So you actually, like the actors don't know the information, so that you actually have to have the characters talk about it. But that adds another aspect to it where you now hear how the character actually relays this information. And if there are bits and pieces left out or how it's colored will then affect how everyone responds to it. Which I find very interesting in and of itself.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I just loved the reveal of, Orin, you met my mum. What?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's insane.
What are you talking about? You met my mum. No.
Did we, the audience, realize?
Brilliant. Just a brilliant moment.
We knew that was.
Because. Because Gwen and Juna scryed
first,
on
Sigrid. They scryed on Gwen's mum, and then Orin was there, and they're like, oh my god. But Orin had no idea.
Yeah.
So there was this whole, like, does he know? He doesn't know it's Gwen's mum. Oh my god. Oh my god. And then it's like, what? Are they going to tell him? Is he going to know? Is he going to figure it? Like, what?
Yeah.
So just such a fun thing, even though we already all know what it was. It was nice to hear.
And that's quite a novel thing, actually, isn't it? For the audience to be, certainly in the timeline of things, for the audience to be a step ahead of a character. That's quite, like, I don't know if we've had that before, certainly in this campaign, when we've been like, I know who that is.
True. Because they don't split the party to that extent most of the time. Yeah.
Nope.
I think this is the first time. I wonder if they're going to do a similar thing for Enkidu. Because Daryl, in real life, as of this recording, is currently in the United States. So I'm wondering if he's unavailable for recordings at the moment with his show Yippee-ki-yay. I'm wondering if we'll have a similar thing for Enkidu at some point, where Enkidu experiences stuff and then comes back and tells the rest of the group and we have another conversation about that.
I think everybody should have their own mini-adventure occasionally. That'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be really cool to see what happens.
Or little prequel episodes.
Oh, yeah. Or like side things like, oh, yeah, this was happening just during some of the downtime in the adventure.
Yeah.
This person went off and did kind of a side thing.
Yeah.
Oh, love a side quest.
I mean, I expect Juna scries on everybody all the time. We only see the ones we're allowed to see.
Yes. I love the idea that Juna's just always watching what other people are doing. but have y'all ever done like a one-on-one D&D session?
No.
Or TTRPG session in general?
I did as DM once for someone. It was like half a session.
Okay.
So that they could kind of, it was either to bring them into a campaign or it was because they'd gone off and done something. And it was really cool then when they rejoined or joined to have them come in and have all this information. And me as the DM be like, are they going to say it? Are they going to say, oh, no, they're not going to. Oh, but they are going to say that. Oh, and it just very fun to see what people choose
to reveal,
to give. Because like, you know, you can give people a little bit of a lore dump and be like, okay, here you go. And then you can see how much of this is actually going to make it to the rest of the party.
Yep.
And sometimes it's really annoying when it doesn't. And you're like, I was really hoping you would tell them that. Now I have to think of a different way.
I think that those kinds of games allow both the player and the DM or GM to like drill in more to the characterization and like what's actually going on with these people. Like the fewer characters you have to deal with, the more you can explore the characters you have. So you can end up in just a short amount of time getting to discover a whole lot about your PCs. Because it's like, well, the story is all about you and how you engage with stuff. And I've run a few one-on-one sessions before. And a lot of times they're some of my favorite ones, especially if it's like part of a larger campaign and you just do like a side thing with its one-on-one. It feels really special. It is like, whoa. And then, like you said, you then go back and it's like, nobody knows exactly what everybody else's characters have been up to. Yeah. But there's like a reunion and it's like, oh, this person has kids now. Whoa. Oh, that person is like, that person nearly caused an international incident. Whoa. That person has a budding romance, perhaps, with the person that used to be their worst enemy. Whoa. Like that kind of stuff.
Fun. Oh, I remember I had a really great one where it was, I was running Curse of Strahd, and each of the player characters had an individual session where they met Strahd and Strahd von Zarevich. And so he made them offers and told them all different things, trying to pit them against each other. Great fun. Also super fun to roleplay someone like evil as hell and really psychologically mess with the characters. And then see the aftermath. So they all suddenly went from being this really close-knit bonded group to suddenly there was these fractures appearing that had been seeded by the evil guy. And it was like, are they going to cotton on to that's exactly what he wanted? Mm-hmm. Or are they actually kind of taking the bait? So that was really fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Roleplay is an evil vampire lord who likes to mess with people. That's my advice.
Anyway, I would totally listen to that with the Abrica lads, like some one-on-ones for each of them. Yeah.
That would be cool.
Oh my God, yeah. Even in the snippets we get, like, you know, the episodes where they like go off shopping and doing stuff. Like thinking about when they were all getting gifts for each other and Gaius just was like, I'm going to go off and steal stuff and
pretend to be heroin.
Forge signatures and make consequences happen. Like, even that as a tiny snippet, like 20 minutes, was so good.
Yeah. I think it would. I'm just going to throw this out as an idea. If y'all ever have scheduling issues in the future, that could be a fun thing where it's like, well, this person's available. Let's go do like Pip suggested, a prequel or something that happens during the series where we didn't really know what their character was up to. We just drill in more as to what they are up to and their inner thoughts and inner lives. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah.
Orin and his mystery crush.
Yes.
Yep.
That's true.
Just saying.
Speaking of mystery crushes,
yes,
I did want to say before we wrap this up, I because the note did take up a little bit of time, I did want to at least highlight that we do have a little bit of what appears to be a burgeoning love triangle
occurring with
Enkidu, Dwayne, and Gwendolyn.
Oh my God, I love it so much.
Yeah. I had never heard Grace's response to it before, so I was interested to hear that, like, the implication of when she heard that Petra had, like, possessed Dwayne and was inside of his body, her response was like, oh, no. I had forgotten that Petra, like, straight up propositioned Dwayne
at
the end of the previous, and Dwayne was like, I'm sure Gwendolyn will probably be fine with it. Ah. Yeah. And then Gwendolyn's like, oh, okay. Right, well, this episode, I was like, oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And I think we were talking in the last Superfan chats about how Dwayne's been around for a while. He probably is like, I'll try it. I'll try some stuff. Like, I'm over 1,000 years old or however old he is, or, you know, close to 1,000 years, whatever it is. Like, you got a lot of time to try things. but also talking about how Enkidu is like such a Mr. Darcy type.
100%.
Yeah. Like that repressed, like, I love it. I love the love triangle. I think I can't wait to see how it goes.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've been on Team Gwenkidu since probably episode 6, mm-hmm. but Dwendolyn, it's getting to me. Now I'm like, oh no.
Yeah, it's a bit like Mr. Darcy versus Jack Sparrow. In that, like, these are your two options.
Wow.
Like, they're both writing you. They're like, one of them is weirdly not Mr. Darcy, is writing you like love letters, and then you have Mr. Darcy there, like, well, I'm training you in the ways of the blade. Yeah, that's an interesting dichotomy.
Well, if we resolve nothing else this campaign, it needs to be that.
Yeah, and if Mr. Darcy were also like, I might be a demon or a robot, I don't know.
Yes.
Possibly both.
Yes.
Yeah. what a fun little, very varied trio of episodes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They really were.
Yeah.
Do we have any favorite moments to wrap up with? Or unanswered questions that we haven't yet covered very quickly?
One of my favorites is that Orin met Gwendolyn's mom. I just think that's such a cool thing, because everything to do with Gwendolyn's mom has been so vague and distant and such like a mystery, that for one of the characters to just straight up meet her and not have, he has no idea it's her, and the other characters are like, ha! In the background as he's doing it. I think that's such a cool idea. I really, really like that.
Yeah,
that was awesome. I don't know about unanswered questions. I think I've kind of put all my questions and theories out there. But favorite moments. I do think it is Dwayne and Orin meeting, and Dwayne just being so blank on who Orin is. Just like, sorry, who are you again?
Yep.
Like, it was so funny to me. It's so true. Like, yes, you. Just, it was so relatable and so enjoyable as a moment. I just loved it. Yep. I really loved it.
Slightly
after
awkward.
All the sort of all the lore dump and the Gwen's mom and the Petra body weirdness and the figuring out the political stuff, and then it's like, oh, that guy, cool. How have you been since you murdered some horses?
That was definitely inspired, at least partly, by if you've ever seen the Family Guy Star Wars movies that they did, the Star Wars adaptations.
Blue I think Hollis-
it was. But it was with the second or third one where Han Solo straight up can't remember C-3PO's name because he never says it. Like, I don't think he ever says his name in the movies.
Okay.
And so in the thing, he's like, this is Sarge here. And he's like, what? It was sort of like that. Hey there, chief.
Yeah. Yep. You.
Good oh, it's you.
See you.
You old rascal.
Yeah. I, Dwayne, am really excited to see you.
Yeah, that was
really fun. That was definitely a favorite moment of mine, I think. Just fun. Just really fun.
I think mine, it was like a small little one, but in the episode 79 when they were in the grove, I really enjoyed Gwen trying to ask questions to the carving of Sylvie and then it resulting in the apple falling on the head. And we could talk a whole lot more about the implications of that and whether that means anything at all or if it's just David playing with Grace and going, an apple fell on your head. It is what it is. Of course, that means nothing. It's just an apple. Or it might be like the key to unlocking everything. We just don't know.
Yeah. And then Gwen's like, oh, well, it's quite a nice apple, but I did get hit on the head. What does it mean?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like,
is it worth the risk?
However you want to take it.
Yeah. It's always worth the risk sitting under a tree when an apple falls on your head. Sure.
Maybe you'll discover gravity. Great. Who knows?
Yeah. Maybe it's a magic apple.
Very true.
Apparently, Gwen couldn't discern whether it was. Seemed normal.
I mean, I had like half sort of Isaac Newton vibes and half like, is it Snow White with the poisoned apple?
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
My head went to both places instantly, and I was like, this could go either way.
Yeah.
One or the other.
Or maybe
just collapses.
Yeah.
The next episode.
I know, that would have been awful.
Yeah.
Oh my God. She's got her bug scars. She's eating a poisoned apple.
Yeah.
Gwen's just not, straight up, not having a great time.
No.
Bless her. Oh, I really can't wait to see what happens next. I'm so excited. It feels like we're getting closer to some real exciting question answering
things. Unlocking some more things for Enkidu, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, secrets. Secrets revealed. Please, please.
I have heard that there's a lot of wildness and excitement not far around the corner. That is what I
have heard that too, mm-hmm. that there's something coming that is like big deal. Yeah. So I'm pretty stoked.
Yeah.
And hopefully if you're a member of the Patreon, you'll get it just a little bit earlier. Ooh, yes. As well as other cool stuff.
Yeah. Good plug.
Yeah.
And with that, should we go ahead and wrap up this installment of Superfan Chats?
I think we should.
Yeah. It's been so fun.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the next few episodes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. We'll see you at some point in the future. Thank you all for joining us. Let us know what you thought in the Discord. If you're not part of the Discord, join it. It's fun. It's a lot of fun community getting built there. But we'll see you all next time for more Superfan Chats.
Anon for now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.